It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Frith Street in Soho, W1. One street north of the Taj Mahal killing. A few doors south of the 5 shilling striptease. The same building as the last failed erection by the Blackout Ripper. And a few doors down from the shopkeeper who sold more than bacon. Coming soon to Murder Mile. At 47 Frith Street, currently stands Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club, a musical institution, where nightly swarms of hipsters form, wearing cravats, bow ties, monocles, feather bows and top hats. As nothing says, I've no personality, like dressing like a Victorian street urchin at a Mardi Gras. And where they hope to hear some nice jazz. Like, you know, something with a recognisable melody. But instead they end up listening to that freeform bollocks, which sounds like an asthmatic stomping a seal pup to death. Back in the 1960s, at 47 Frith Street was a seedy little strip club called Peeperama, where sad losers got their jollies by ogling bored ladies as they jiggled their wobbly bits. One of those ladies was Elaine Baker, a young woman with dreams, who was described as one of the shyest striptease artists I've ever met. And although it looked like she was having fun, behind her painted on smile lay pain and anger. My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 232. Finally, a home. Everybody has a dream. For some, it's something they can achieve by themselves. Whether to paint, to write, or to build a business, where all they need is themselves and belief. Whereas for others, like Elaine, her dream of a home, a marriage, and several children required a second person, a husband. Elaine Baker began life as Elaine Barkworth on the 10th of August 1936. She said she knew little about her early life, her family and her upbringing. But maybe her childhood was something she had chosen to forget. Raised in the district of Bucklow in Cheshire, she never spoke of her father. She didn't have a loving relationship with her mother, and as at least one of 5 siblings, being taken into care when she was only 12, she spent most of her formative years in foster care. denied love and guidance. As she was bounced between care homes and foster parents, owing to her parents' neglect. Although her abandonment had made her incredibly caring and maternal, with a deep desire to be loved and also to give love. Regressing into herself, she became the epitome of shyness. As a short, curvy redhead with pale skin and freckles, she had always looked young and later described as a pathetic little creature. For the price of a kiss, a hug, or a little compassion, she was often easily led. In 1954, when she was 18, her foster mother died. And although legally an adult, no longer being the burden of the council's responsibility, she was out on her own, even though she was still only a child. Described as being of lower than average intelligence, owing to inconsistent schooling, she earned her way as a single girl through a series of manual jobs in laundries and hotels. And through necessity, she received 3 minor convictions, one for the theft of a coat and stockings, one for breach of probation, and the other for using insulting words. She wasn't a bad person. She just lacked trust in other people, and for good reason. Her late teens were riddled with more tragedy than most people could cope with in their lifetime. In 1953, age 17, she lost all contact with her mother and her father she couldn't remember. On the 18th of August 1955, age 19, she gave birth to a child. But being illegitimate, in an era where a single mother was as sinful as theft, she was forced to give it up for adoption. And on the 14th of May 1956, after just 3 weeks of unhappy, abusive marriage to Carl G. Baker, yet another dream was shattered. In August 1958, with no family, no home, no children, and no marriage, every part of her fantasy had broken. And being desperate to leave all of her pain behind, she fled to London to start a new life. Three months later, she would meet Ronnie, the man of her dreams. As a shy, uncertain girl, it took real courage to come out from behind her shadow to work as a cinema usherette at the Troxy in East London's Commercial Road. Burdened by a soft voice, a quiet manner, and a pale face which blushed like a little cherry tomato whenever a stranger spoke more than a few words to her. Although far from outgoing, maybe it was her childlike qualities which lured Ronnie towards her. 3 years her junior, 20-year-old Ronald Leonard Cross was born and raised in London. As a 6-foot, 3-inch hunk of loveliness, with a boyish face, a mop of dark hair, and a big beaming smile. Although he towered over this tiny redhead, Elaine was instantly smitten. Seeing him as marriage material, they moved in together, and with him earning 3 times her wage as he was a labourer, life looked promising. Elaine would state, "For 6 or 7 months, we lived together as man and wife. Unable to afford much, at the start of March, they moved into a small basement room in a shared lodging at 19 Tredegar Square in Bow. And although it was basic, it was their home." barely 10 feet square, with not even enough space to swing the proverbial cat. Although their bed-sitting room was a little pokey, it had everything this young couple needed. A sofa which folded out into a bed, a radio to play their records on, a decent-sized wardrobe for all of their clothes, and even 2 porcelain cats to make it look nice. It was the start of something special for Elaine. Finally, she had a home, with a job that she liked, a man who she loved, and having come from nothing, there was talk of the things she dreamed of the most. A happy marriage, many babies, and a life of unbridled happiness. Her dream had finally come true. And yet, once again, it would end in tragedy. It made sense that Ronnie paid the lion's share for the bills. But as a bone-idle dawdler, who despised the daily grind, and would rather spaff his cash up the wall by seeing his pals and quaffing pints. "I used to get annoyed," Elaine would state, "because Ron wouldn't go out to work." In short, he couldn't be asked. In court, the judge described Ronnie as a worthless creature who treated her like an oriental chattel. With the Troxy on its final year as a cinema, shifts were short, and with there being few jobs that she could do, "We had 1 or 2 arguments about this," she said, "but we always made up afterwards." It was then that instead of agreeing to get off his arse and to earn an honest living as any prospective husband with half a brain cell and even an ounce of love in his heart would do, that he made Elaine an indecent proposal. It wasn't her thing, but it was said that Ronnie had taken her to Freddy's Tropicana Club on Greek Street in Soho. It served drinks, and it played music. Only it wasn't a nightclub, but a striptease. The Tropicana at 11 Greek Street was a seedy little cesspit, hidden under a cheesy cafe and accessed by a set of dark-lit steps. It led down to a dingy basement, which stunk of bad breath, body odour, stale ciggies, and an unnervingly salty stench which made anyone with a working set of nostrils gag and retch. As the only female customer, Elaine couldn't help but feel a sickening wave of revulsion wash over her, as a gaggle of perverted little gits, grinning lasciviously as they eyed her tiny body up and down. Only Ronnie hadn't brought her here for fun, but for work. Having nagged incessantly, although a shy girl who blushed uncontrollably and was insecure about her shape, he wanted her to become a stripper. Yes, she would hate it. Yes, she was afraid. And yes, just the thought of it made her feel nauseous. But with it paying £12 a week, 3 times her minuscule wage as a cinema usherette, a little bit of saucy nudity would clear their back rent and any unpaid bills until he found work and got back on his feet. That was the plan. It was something she didn't want to do, but for him, she would. And with the Tropicana's owners also running the Piperama on Frith Street, although the manageress said she was the shyest striptease artist there, Elaine's demureness lured in the perverts, who through her fantasized about shy young girls. She started stripping at the start of March. After that, Ronnie didn't work again. Friday the 23rd of April 1960 started out as most days often did, with an argument. Over the past few weeks, as he became lazier and often woke late with a hangover after a jolly night out with his pals, all paid for by her. As their fights had become more physical, she used makeup to hide the bruises. 3 days before, Ronnie had finally got a job labouring on a building site. Elaine would say, "I set the alarm for 7:30 a.m. But he didn't get up. Having made breakfast, Elaine used a torch to navigate this messy bed sitting room, as the light switch he said he would fix was still broken. And with him still in bed, as I left at 11:05 a.m, I asked him if he was going to work. He said he was. And as I left our room, I left the door open, thinking that that would help him get up. But as I went up the stairs to head out, he slammed the door shut, and that made me mad." With 10 shillings in her purse, she had given him 2/3 to put food in the cupboard, which she hoped that he would do. And although she'd work a 12-hour shift until nearly midnight to earn enough money for them, she rightly guessed that by the time she got back, he'd be drunk. The Peeperama at 47 Frith Street was as equally seedy as the Tropicana. Being just shy of Old Compton Street, this side of Soho was surrounded by pubs, brothels, and similarly seedy establishments, which catered for some of the most pathetic losers imaginable, who live for drinking, leering, wanking. Like any other striptease, this venue was as erotic as an abattoir, as a parade of bored women sat behind a foul-smelling curtain, waiting to be ogled like pieces of meat, before a group of drooling deadbeats. For these stars of the show, there was no dressing room, no glamour, and no hints of Hollywood. Just a few stools, a brimming ashtray, a curtain rail of unwashed slutty outfits that they'd wear for barely a few minutes, a cracked makeup mirror with a single stark bulb overhead, and an overflowing toilet. For Elaine, "I learned the job, but I didn't like it." So as the purple curtains were pulled apart, again, like a wound-up automaton, she started to dance. With no stage, just a sticky carpet, a single light which was hardly flattering, and a cheesy track playing in mono through a crackly record player. Surrounded by a semicircle of creaky chairs and sleazy men stifling semis, a sea of leering eyes ate up every inch of her unveiling skin, as with hands in their pockets, they all bobbed up and down to the sexy rhythm. Still painfully shy, as much as she hated it, Elaine did what she needed to do to live and to survive. Like so many others, although her body danced, behind her eyes she was dead. As the second she saw the sad bastards before her, she knew that all she wanted to do was to spit in their faces or to be sick. So as she jiggled her bare breasts a few feet from several possible rapists, three things occupied her mind. Hunger, as having given her boyfriend every penny she had, only able to afford a sandwich and a cup of tea all day. She was weak and tired, and aware that the audience could hear her rumbling belly. Drugs, as being conscious of her weight, struggling to stay awake, and needing something to soothe her pain and shame. She'd started drinking and taking Preludin, an appetite suppressant and a stimulant. And finally, there was hope. As still believing that her dream would one day come true, I hoped that Ronnie would get a job and that one day we'd get married. But deep down, she must have known she was lying to herself. As back home, a nightmare awaited her. At midnight, Elaine exited the tube at Bow. Her feet aching after 12 hours, tottering in high heels, dodging kisses and ducking gropes, as a butt crack of losers headed home to their wife's cold shoulder. With her cheeks sore from grinning inanely, as she entered the dark silence of Tredegar Square, again her belly rumbled, having barely eaten a thing all day. She hoped that she'd be welcomed home by her husband-to-be with a soft kiss, followed by a nice meal lovingly prepared by him. But it was not to be. When I walked into the kitchen, I saw there was no meal. There were no plates on the table, nothing boiling on the hob, and no food in the cupboard, just a half bag of old potatoes, barely at their best. I went into the front room, which was in darkness, as after weeks of complaining, he hadn't even attempted to fix the light switch. In fact, he'd done nothing. Flicking on her lighter, by its limp orange glow, I saw Ronnie lying on the bed with his clothes on. Him all sprawled out like he'd had a hard day. The stale odour of beer and cigarettes on his breath, and the 7 shillings she had given him for food was gone, having blown it all and getting pissed with his pals. I asked him if he'd been to work. He rolled over and said, "What's it to you?" I said, "If I'm working, so should you. Or are you going to start your old tricks again?" He then said, "I'm sick." I replied, "The only thing you're sick with is idleness." He then called me a bloody bastard. And as I turned, he jumped out of bed and we argued. And as he slapped me around the face, I tried to hit him back, but I couldn't reach him. As this 6'3" hulk towered over the tiny frame of Elaine. She told Detective Superintendent Beale, "I walked into the kitchen and went to a drawer and took out a knife." When asked, "Is this the knife?" Showing her a small 4-inch blade, she replied, "Yes. I was going to peel some potatoes and make chips. Ronnie came in behind me. I asked him if he wanted any. He said, 'What do you care if I eat or not?' We had words, and he hit me on the nose and the forehead." And as her eyes filled and her nose bled red, knowing this would be another bruise she'd have to hide, as she stood there shaking, she knew that this was what her life had become. There was no dream, only shit. What happened next may never be known, as Elaine's recollection was hazy at best. Initially, she told the police, "When I went into the hall, he was lying there, covered in blood." The DS asked,
"As far as you were aware, you were the only person in the basement with him at that time. So how do you suggest that he was stabbed?"
A witch chief replied,
"I don't know. He might have done it himself. He was always saying he was fed up."
As those words stumbled from her fumbling mouth, they all knew it was a lie. As her fingerprints were found on the knife's handle, and his blood had poured down her waist, her legs, and her feet. Only it was clear that she was not an evil woman hell-bent on murdering her man. This was just a frightened girl who was in panic and fear, grasping at straws, as the life she had always dreamed of was now over. Later, Elaine would claim that it was an accident.
"He walked out into the hall and called, 'Elaine, Elaine.' At first, I thought he was fooling. I walked out and saw Ronnie lying on the floor, crouched up, and a lot of blood. And I realized I must have stabbed him with a knife."
At that point, unsure what to do, Elaine shouted for Michael Malloy, a laborer who lodged in the back room on the ground floor, who had always been very decent to both of them. When questioned, Michael confirmed,
"I went to sleep and I heard a scream. I thought I was having a nightmare, so I took no notice. A couple of minutes later, I heard Elaine calling me hysterically,
Michael,
and I thought something was wrong."
And it was.
"I found Ronnie lying at the bottom of the stairs on his stomach. I turned him over and saw blood. Elaine was kneeling over him. She was sobbing and calling his name."
As blood pooled around Ronnie like a sticky red halo, desperate to stop the bleeding, Michael started searching for a wound.
"I said, 'This chap has been stabbed.' But at that, she made no comment."
With the ambulance arriving faster than the police, as Elaine got in to accompany Ronnie to hospital, when PC Adams asked,
"What happened?"
Again, in panic, she said,
"I don't know. I didn't see."
Not realizing that everything she said and everything she did would be used in evidence against her. With Ronnie gasping for breath, when the ambulance man asked,
"What happened?"
she said she didn't know. She said she'd tell him later. And then
he was playing with a knife and had an accident.
And although they had sped just a short distance to Mile End Hospital, by the time they'd arrived, Dr. Lucas would inform Elaine that Ronnie was dead. Questioned at 1:20 a.m., barely an hour after their fight, asked to tell the truth, Elaine sobbed,
"I did it. I was making chips. I had a knife in my hand, and I said, 'Have you been drinking?' He said, 'Yeah, so what? I'm not going to sit and wait for you every evening.' I saw red and struck out with the knife."
An autopsy conducted by Dr. F. E. Camps at Poplar Mortuary would confirm
he had superficial scratches to his right arm and his upper chest, and a single stab wound midway between the nipples, which passed between the ribs and embedded 4 inches deep through the end of the heart and part of one of the valves.
And with the scientific officer of the Met Police's laboratory, unable to find any trace of alcohol in his blood or his urine, and Elaine having changed her story several times to several witnesses, having started with nothing, now her life was over. Held at Holloway Prison, the medical officer would state,
"She'd shown no evidence of mental illness and had extensive bruising to the left-hand side of her forehead, her upper chest, her upper arms, both thighs and lower legs. And although described as impulsive and emotional, she didn't show any signs of aggression, but she got upset talking about her past."
With the press taking pity on her predicament, a nationwide appeal was made to find her parents. And after almost 7 years apart, Elaine and her mother Constance were reunited at Holloway Prison. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 21st of May 1960, she pleaded not guilty to the charge of murder owing to provocation. When cross-examined, the Met Police's scientific officer stated that no alcohol was detected
because it was destroyed at a rate of 0.75 pints per hour.
And with the pathologist confirming that, although considerable force had been used to stab him,
if at the time the body was moving forward, it doesn't need a great deal of force. It need be no more than a simple push.
Implying that if he was moving forward to attack her, she could conceivably have stabbed him by mistake, as she had initially thought. Described by the judge as a pathetic creature who was full of remorse for the man she still loved. 3 days later, and after 3 hours of deliberation, a jury of 9 men and 3 women found her not guilty of murder and not guilty of manslaughter. As she was led away to her freedom, when interviewed on the steps of the Old Bailey, she said,
"I was very much in love. I felt I could reform him. Perhaps then, for the first time in my life, I would have a home."
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Could be a long one. We'll cut that one down.
Yeah, good. Oh! Oh! Yawn o'clock. Hello, everyone. How you doing?
How you doing?
Oh, take your little hat off. There we go. Put that aside. Oh, I'm going to open up a window. Even though it's cold out, it's bitterly cold. You can tell winter, autumn, all the leaves have come down now. It's really wet and it's really soggy outside. And I wasn't going to have the windows open. I had to put all of my usual blockades up because there's a prick outside with a little JCB. Oh, it's a nice place where I'm currently moored up. It's very nice. It's very peaceful. I like it here. It's near a cake shop, although I haven't been in there yet. I'm being good. It's near a nice little coffee shop. But immediately opposite, there's a couple of boats moored up, and there's a guy. He's obsessed, absolutely obsessed with getting out. He's got one of those tiny little JCBs, and he's obsessed all day with driving it around and moving shit. He'll get stuff, he'll move it from one end to the other, and then he'll move it back. He doesn't seem to do anything all day, just does that. And then he goes, oh, I need to get my mower out, even though I just mowed the other day. I'm going to mow again. Oh, lovely. Great, that seems to be his life. So I made it three quarters of the way through recording this, and then he started up his JCB, and I thought, oh, you shit, you utter shit. And then I glared at him as he was moving his it's not even a JCB, it's a crappy little tiny, it's like a baby JCB. It's like it was Christmas and mummy had gone, oh, let's buy you a little JCB. That's the kind he's got. And he's moving his shit around, but he stopped, which was good. So I was able to whiz through this and get it done, which is good. Not going to make a cup of tea because I'm early today. It's 11 o'clock. This was quite an easy episode for me to write. I liked her and I kind of understood her. So it was kind of easy to write for me. So I kind of whizzed through it. So normally at this point, if I'm doing well, I'd normally start recording now. But I finished at 11 o'clock, which means I can walk into town and have a nice cuppa, I think. So I'm going to do that. So I'm not going to make a cup of tea today. I'm still not on cake. I'm still being good. Although it is Saturday today. So I will treat myself to one of those big tubs of vegan ice cream. Very good stuff. Very good stuff. If you... Little aircraft about to go by. Yes. The little businessman pricks are out today. And there's someone about to go past in their wide beam. And they're... You can hear the engine gunning it. He's on his phone. He doesn't give a shit. He's not looking where he's going. And my boat is about to go bang. You can hear him. What a tit. Anyway. No cake. No cake. Still doing good, though. Still doing good. Weight is still coming off. There was a lot of weight to come off. A lot of flabby old flab. So I won't be as warm this winter because, as we know, flab is really just there to keep you warm through winter. But I won't have enough. I just want to get healthy. That's really what I want to do. And I realise my legs are good because I walk. I worked it out a little while ago. I walk every year the distance of between London and Baghdad. That's how far I walk every year. I do about half a million steps a month. I think is what I'm on at the moment, which is good, but my upper half is useless. And I was like, what am I going to do? Because I don't want to go into gym. And welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit. Don't worry, we've got some quiz questions in a bit and then we'll do some extra stuff. But we have a little waffle at the start. I don't like going to the gym because it's all full of arseholes. You have those arseholes who've like gone out and they bought their expensive Lycra stuff and their expensive trainers. And they're all about, oh, look at me. And you always get that prick who gets on the running machine and they do that speed thing where they do 1 minute at an excessive pace and then they get off and go, and they sweat everywhere and it's all about, oh, look at me, I'm a twat. I hate that kind of shit. So here's a good exercise tip for you. I've been using two tins of sweet corn. So two big tins of sweet corn, and I do 50 reps over my head, 50 reps to the side, 50 reps in a swimming position, 50 reps behind. And I do that in the morning and at lunchtime and then tea time and then just before I go to bed. So that's about 1,000 reps with those a day. And it's you do it while you're making a cup of tea or something like that because it's quick to do. And it's getting there. I think my arms are starting to tone up a bit. The only reason I want to do that is because, A, you need to have better... I want to have better upper body strength, which I don't really have. But also, you know, my legs are good, but the upper half is now looking at a bit flabby because all the fat's coming off, and therefore the skin is kind of just hanging there. Eva still loves it. She you know, she makes me strip, and she stands there and she goes, "Oh, me a piece of that," and then she throws up, which I hope isn't because of me. It's normally is because of all the vodka, but you know what she's like. Anyway, thank you to 2 new Patreon supporters. So thank you, Robin Poynter. So thank you very much. Thank you to Darth. Hope that's not the Darth Vader. You don't know. You never really know, do you? And then someone who just calls himself the One. So thank you, Robin. Thank you, Darth. And thank you, The. Because your first name will be The. So I can't call you the One, because One is clear your surname. Thank you also to Gloria Wrighton, who sent a very kind donation via the Murder Mile Facebook. There's not Facebook, though. My webpage, there's a donation thing on there. Note to self, I must check the supporter app. Sorry, if anyone does send me a donation on the supporter app, it's very kind of you. And I really do appreciate it. But because it's powered by Acast, they don't inform us of this at all. So you have to go into the website, and then you have to go into one drop down box, and then you have to go right to the bottom where it goes supporter app, which is almost impossible to find. And then you have to go searching for it elsewhere. It's a real pain in the ass, and they don't send you an email to say, "You've had a nice donation." Whereas through my website, because I built it, it comes straight to me and it says there's a donation, and then I can email you back and say thank you. Supporter app. I'm going to have to check it today. I haven't checked it in a while, so sorry about that. So if you have sent through a donation through that, I'm sorry if I haven't said thank you yet. Let's do some quiz questions. So get ready, folks. Let's see how many you can do. Question number one. What building currently stands at 47 Fifth Street? Question number two. What was Elaine's birth name? Question number three, what three minor convictions did she have? Question number four, what was the name of her husband? Question number five, what cinema did she work at? Question number six, how much did Ronnie earn per week as a labourer? There's a little rat outside, a little tiny dog making rat sounds. Get a proper dog. Question number seven. How much did Elaine earn per week as a stripper? Question number eight. What was the name of the striptease that Ronnie, it is said, had taken her to initially? Question number nine. What had she eaten and drank all day? And question number ten. What hospital was Ronnie taken to? So let's dive into some stuff. Don't forget, I haven't edited this yet, so I may edit out the bits where that question is relating to that, or I may balls up that bit of the question. But because this bit isn't edited deliberately, if I do make cock it up, I'm not going to take it out of the episode. So there we go. To Ronnie. Full name, Ronald Leonard Cross. He was 20. Born kind of spring 1939. He was a builder's labourer. Her nickname for him was Potter, but we don't know why. No idea at all. 6 feet 3 inches tall, slim, boyish face, dark hair. Although in court he was described by the judge as a worthless creature who was willing to live on her earnings and treated her like an oriental chattel. We don't really know much about him. We know he's got a brother called Edward. He's got a father called Edward. And I think he's got a sister called Eileen as well. But that's all we really know about. There wasn't much in the file at all about him. That day, as mentioned, it had been quite an ordinary day. He'd got the day of the murder, he'd got a job on the Tuesday. So 3 days before, he'd got a job on a building site. But even at that point, she's kind of saying to him, "Why aren't you getting up? Why aren't you going out and doing your job?" And he just can't be asked anymore. I think we don't really know much about him. We don't know much about his background. We don't know whether he's got a criminal record. There was no witness statements from anyone saying anything positive about him or negative about him. So we really don't know that much about him. We don't know what his motives are, but it seemed to be, according to her, that by the time that she was earning more money than he was as a stripper, that he'd decided, to quit. Which is kind of... when you think about the money they were making, Joe, with both of them, even though she was a cinema usher on, I think she was on four, I think it was £4.07. So that would have been a relatively not bad wage for both of them. They could have survived on that, but living off just one wage, it just doesn't make any sense at all. It really doesn't. What have we got? What have we got? What have we got? This is just not in any particular order. This is just how I've kind of put things out. I'm not going to say too much about the prior to the murder because we kind of covered that heavily. We'll cover the bits around the kind of the discovery of the body because a lot of that I kind of shortened down to kind of make it flow better as an episode. But on the day of the offence, she stated that she had drank some alcohol and some Preludin, which was, as mentioned in the episode, was a stimulant drug first synthesized in 1952 and originally used as an appetite suppressant. This was withdrawn from the market in the 1980s due to widespread abuse. That sounds really weird. A drug being marketed by the drugs companies and then widespread abuse. Well, there we go. That hasn't happened in any other countries, has it? So, yeah, that was... she was on that, but it was an appetite suppressant. But also, she's trying to find ways to get herself through the day. Also, it's kind of, when you think the reason why I mentioned that in there is because she was clearly very conscious of her weight and her size, and you know she's quite a shy person, and she's on stage stripping and having men ogle her body, and yet at the same time she's conscious of how she looks, so she's. This isn't just something that she's shy of doing. This is something that she's very nervous about her body, and yet she, in order to make money for both of them, she's kind of having men ogling and judging her body, which is kind of something. It shows how it's something that she really didn't want to do. Returning home, so I'll try and read much of this. Don't forget, she changes bits and pieces here and there, so it won't be a consistent. Statement. She said, I went to the club and returned home at 12:15 a.m. and walked straight into the kitchen to see if he had cooked a meal for me as he had promised. When I walked into the kitchen, I saw there was no meal, so I went into the front room, which was in darkness. The electric light was faulty and sometimes the switch doesn't work. I saw Ronnie lying on the bed with his clothes on by the light of my lighter, which I flicked on. I put it out and walked towards the wardrobe and knocked over a bottle of milk, and then I started to undress and to wash. Ronnie was awake and I asked him if he'd been to work. He turned round and said, what do you want to know for? I said, if I'm working, so should you, or are you going to start your old tricks again? By this, I meant not bothering to work. He said, I'm sick. I used this in the episode. I replied, the only thing you are sick of is with idleness. Ronnie then called me a bloody bastard. As I turned towards him, he jumped up out of the bed and went into the kitchen and then came back again. This is where they started arguing. They had an argument. Part of the argument was this. I didn't put it in the episode because it throws it off, but we had an argument over a clock he had got the previous day, and eventually he admitted that his sister had given him 5 shillings to buy it. This made me cross because he knew that we only had 4 shillings that day and that extra money could have been used for food. We continued to argue about whether he had been paid at work or got a sub, during which he called me a few names. And then he slapped me around the face and I tried to hit him back, but I couldn't reach him. As mentioned in the episode, she's only about 5 foot, 5 foot dot, and he's 6'3". So there's a real height difference there. Don't forget, given the fact that he's taller, also his reach on his arms are a hell of a lot more as well. Then I walked into the kitchen and went to the drawer in the cabinet and took out a knife. When questioned, Detective Superintendent Beale said, is this the knife? Elaine said, yes, that is the one. I was going to peel some potatoes and make some chips, but Ronnie came in behind me. So I asked him if he wanted any. He said, what do you care if I eat or not? What a tit. We had further words and I tried to hit him with my left hand, but he hit me on the nose and the forehead. She I use this quote in there as well. She also said, I still had the knife in my other hand and I said, have you been drinking? He said, yes, I have. And I'm not going to sit and wait for you every evening. And then I saw red and struck out with a knife. That's kind of one of the things that almost convicted her was the fact that she said, I struck out with the knife. Whereas it's not like she said, I stabbed him. It's like, I struck out. It's kind of an odd phrasing there. It doesn't really nail it down. Elaine said, and then he walked out into the little passageway, that's the hall, and called Elaine, Elaine. The knife went out with him and must have been caught up somewhere, i.e. still in his chest. But at first, I thought he was just falling about. He then called out for Michael, and I thought something must be wrong, and I walked out into the passage. I saw Ronnie lying on the floor, crouched up, and a lot of blood, and I realised I must have stabbed him with a knife. So Michael Malloy was their lodger, who's mentioned lived in the back room on the ground floor. There was also Mr. and Mrs. Hines. His name's Patrick. I can't remember what her name was. I think this is the era where they just didn't list, because she's a woman, they didn't list her first name. She's just Mrs. Hines. They're in the front room on the ground, so just above them. And it was actually Michael Malloy who'd sublet the basement room. They call her Mr. and Mrs. Cross, but it's actually Eileen and Ronnie. This was an era way what you could do. You could rent out two rooms, and then you, as the rentee, the lodger, could sublet that room. So he had rented out the basement, then he'd done it up, and he'd rented it out to them, even though he's not the lodger. See, there's all these are all the pieces that I don't put in the episode because it just confuses everything. But he did say, I went to bed at 11:15 to 11:30 p.m. I went to sleep and I heard a scream. As I'd not been feeling myself, not like that. I thought I was having a nightmare, so I took no notice. A couple of minutes later, I heard Mrs. Cross, that's Elaine, that's what he calls her, calling me hysterically, and I thought something was wrong. I went to the basement where I found Mr. Cross, that's Ronnie, lying at the bottom of the stairs. His feet were at the bottom of the stairs and his head towards the door of the kitchen. There was a light on in the kitchen. There was no light on in the bed sitting room. He was dressed in trousers and a shirt and was lying on his stomach. I turned him over and saw blood. Mrs. Cross, Elaine, was kneeling over Mr. Cross when I first saw them. She was very hysterical and kept calling him Potter. She was only wearing a jumper. Mrs. Cross was very excited, and in trying to find where the blood was coming from, she tore the shirt off completely. I then found a wound on his left side. It's actually kind of more upper middle, so just near the heart-ish. And this chap had been, I said, this chap had been stabbed, but she made no comment. I asked her to fetch something to dress the wound. She went to the bedroom, but as the light there wasn't working, she couldn't find anything. So I went to my room and collected some clean underpants to dress the wound. Well, there you go. I bet it's glad that they were clean. I arranged with Mrs. Hines to call for an ambulance. They kind of did what they did there. And there was kind of... I won't go into... Patrick turned up. Patrick Hines, who was the guy on the ground floor, he came down. He was kind of like, is everything okay? And he saw the blood and he saw the knife there and all this. So he was kind of a second witness who could back up what Michael had seen. But obviously, because an ambulance was called, the ambulance turned up before the police had arrived. And because this was really seen as a domestic and because Ronnie was still alive, therefore, the ambulance took Ronnie away, and because she was his girlfriend, she went with them. So she hadn't been arrested by that point because they couldn't really prove anything. But they had got access to the scene. Ronnie was gasping for breath, and he'd been stabbed under the left nipple. Robert Hunt, the ambulance driver, asked her what happened. At first, she said she didn't know. Then she said, I'll tell you later. She used that a couple of times throughout. And then third, in the ambulance, she said he was playing with a knife and there was an accident. So you can see at this point she's really starting to panic and she doesn't really know what she's doing. PC Adams and PC Somerville arrived at the scene at about 12:40 a.m. Mr. Cross was being carried to the ambulance. Mrs. Cross was on the path crying. Before the ambulance left, I asked her what happened and she said, I don't know, I didn't see. What did PC? That's fine. PC Somerville went in and looked at the scene. She'd said that she was going to cook a meal and was peeling some potatoes. We then messed around for a bit. This was what Elaine said. After that, he called for Michael and I called for Michael too. He noted that in the scene, he saw no food out and no potato peelings in the sink, which you would have expected if she was going to peel some potatoes, but maybe she hadn't peeled the potatoes yet. Detective Inspector Donaldson said that there was a brown carrier bag of potatoes and there was some food in the cupboard, but not much. In fact, he used the words very little. Cynthia Lucas was the hospital doctor. She said at roughly 1 a.m. She examined him. He had a stab wound to the chest, a small incision about half an inch long on the left hand side, but he was already dead. There were no other injuries. Doctor also, while she was there, she examined Elaine. She couldn't see many injuries. Obviously, the bruises were starting to come through and she was still wearing clothes, so most of the bruises were on her body. But she said she was very hysterical and I saw some blood on her foot and leg. Later examined, she had a bruise on her left forearm, so that was probably a defensive wound. She also had a tender bruise over the bridge of the nose. In hospital, Dr. Lucas said to Elaine that Ronald was dead. Again, she became hysterical and kept saying, "It can't be, it can't be." She was like that pretty much throughout. Detective Superintendent James Beale took her back to Bow Police Station, not to be confused with Bow Street Police Station. Bow Street Police Station is just off Covent Garden. Bow Police Station is in East London. D.S. Beale saw the body at the mortuary. Dr. F.E. Camps conducted the mortuary. It was taken at 1:30 p.m. the next day, so that's 12 hours after the murder. He said there were superficial scratches on Ronald's body, two on the right-hand side of his upper chest, one in his left armpit, two just above the midway between the nipples, and he had a stab between the left, kind of midway between his chest, but kind of more on the left-hand side. The stab wound passed between the ribs. It went through the end of the heart and part of one of the valves with a total depth of 4 inches. An internal bleeding into the left-hand side of the cavity was the cause of death. The knife's blade itself was only 3 inches long, so considerable force had been used. But when questioned, as mentioned in the episode, he said, but if at the time the body was moving forwards at the same time, i.e. Ronald was running towards her or moving towards her to attack her, it does not need a great deal of force. It is little more than just an ordinary push. What else we got? As mentioned in the episode, no alcohol was detected in his blood or urine, but because this sample had been taken 12 hours later and alcohol is destroyed at a rate of 3/4 of a pint per hour, depending on how much he drank and when he'd last finished drinking, this is 12 hours later, so most of the alcohol would have gone out of his system. They hadn't got very, very specific ways of, like, obviously now we can detect minute traces. Back then it was just like an alcohol level. There were no visible traces on the knife. PC Somerville said it looked like it had been washed, but there was still fingerprints on there, possibly from where it had been wiped. Sorry, it hadn't been washed, it had been wiped. And his shirt was found at the scene, Ronald's shirt. It was badly bloodstained and ripped at the front. Let's see what else we've got. I think we're getting close. She was admitted to Holloway Prison on the 25th of April 1960. As mentioned, medical assessment, no history of psychiatric mental diseases, no epilepsy, no blackouts. This is something they always check for in when they're doing the medical assessments, because a lot of people use the idea of, oh, do you know, I was in the room and then suddenly I don't remember anything. And it was like, well, do you know, was it a blackout? Was it epilepsy or anything like that? She wasn't. She was just an ordinary person who'd just been pushed to, as everybody has breaking points, don't they? And that was her breaking point. Her dream, she got a dream her whole life of a nice husband and a nice house and having babies and living a lovely life. Do you know, nothing expensive, not fancy holidays and posh cars. She just wanted to, she hadn't got much. She'd come from nothing. She just wanted to have a nice, simple, good life. And that had kind of been taken from her. And that was her breaking point, really. Also, kind of, although her family would say that he was never abusive to her, when she was medically assessed, as mentioned, they said there was extensive bruising to the left-hand side of her forehead, upper chest, upper arms, both thighs and lower legs. She complained of tenderness to the nose. All of these injuries were recent within the time frame of the incident, but they also found quite a few injuries that were older as well. She was considered below the average intelligence, but not enough to warrant the Mental Deficiency Act. Obviously, that's all because of a lack of education, because she was being moved around a lot. Her temperament was impulsive and emotional, but she got on well with the other inmates, and she's not shown any evidence of undue aggression or of being quarrelsome. She is sensitive about the way in which she was reared. So that's kind of a big thing for her. Trial. We did the trial. We dealt with that. One thing we didn't put in there is, as far as I could tell, she was still... I couldn't find a death certificate. She was still technically alive at the start of the 2000s, living in Sale in Cheshire. Coot outside is getting mouthy. And Ronald was buried in Stepney on the 2nd of April 1960 at Tower Hamlets Cemetery Park. I think that's it. I think that's it, folks. I think that's it. Ooh, I get to go off to a coffee shop and have a coffee. Hopefully it's not going to be full of little bastards. Little bastards running around. Oh, it's a Saturday. Can't we have, like, a day off for everyone? Can't we have, like, a Saturday? You just get all kids and you just put them in prison. You put them in prison for the day. You teach them a lesson. You go, if you're not well behaved, you'll end up in prison. And then that means everyone for a whole Saturday, it includes parents as well, get to just have a nice day off. Like with no noise, no child noise, which, as we all know, is the worst noise in the world. You can have nails scraping down a board. That's horrible. But the sound of a child, that's the worst sound in the world. So let's do some quiz questions. It's just a joke, people. It's just a joke. I know someone might know. How dare he say that to children? How dare he say that about my children? I've never met your children. I've no idea what your children... I'm sure your children are nice. They're not. But people get really uptight about shit. This is just a bit of fun, folks. Just a bit of fun. It's all this all is. People get really uptight about just simple things, don't they? And you just think, grow up. Just enjoy life. That's what I'm trying to do, is enjoy life. Have fun. People just get so het up about shit. So let's do some quiz questions. Let's see how well you did. Question number one. What building currently stands at 47 Frith Street? It is Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Welcome to Jazz Club. Nice. I was going to put some of those in, some clips from Fast Show of Jazz Club. Because I wanted some of those little clips of him going, nice, great. But there's laughter all over it, so it wouldn't have worked. I haven't edited this yet, so I haven't decided to do that. Maybe I will. I probably won't. Question number two. What was Elaine's birth name? As far as we know, it was Elaine Barkworth, but might not be true. Question number three. What three minor convictions did she have? She had a theft for a coat and stockings. She had a breach of probation and the use of insulting words. Well, well, well. Question number four. What was the name of her husband? If you said Ronnie, that is incorrect because they weren't married. It was Carl G. Baker. Question number five. What cinema did she work at? It's the Troxy on a Commercial Road, which... ages ago, myself and Adam from UK True Crime did a show there, which and lots of people there, but thinking back on it, it wasn't very good. It wasn't a very good show. It was a bit badly disorganised. It really was. Question number six. How much did Ronnie earn per week as a labourer? It was £11. How much did Elaine earn per week as a stripper? It was £12. What was the name of the striptease Ronnie was said to have taken her to initially? It was the Tropicana Club. Some people called it Freddy's Tropicana Club. Question number 9, what had she eaten and drank all day? It was a sandwich and a cup of tea. And question number 10, what hospital was Ronnie taken to? It was Mile End Hospital. So that's it, folks. That's all done. I hope you enjoyed that. That was this week's episode of Murder Mile. I'm going to go off now and do some more research. I've got to research these next 3 episodes. I think it's 3. As I've already done the final 3 to take us through to Christmas. So I don't know when this is going out, but this is the 14th of October now. So I'm getting myself ahead of the game so I can enjoy Christmas. Anyway, have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. And thank you for supporting the show. Lots of love.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.